wouldn't take long for the rivers round here to rise. Wouldn't take long for the rivers round here to rise. Wouldn't take long for the rivers to rise. Wouldn't be nothing but the sea and the sky. Wouldn't take long for the rivers round here to rise. 40 days.
That's the Dixie Biscuits starting us out this hour. This week, about the climate chaos. How'd we get to this point anyway, and what are we supposed to do about it now? Steve Downing has some thoughts for us on our recent history, and Jeremiah Lin takes us out, way out into the future. But really, how are you doing living with the idea of the looming end of the world as we know it? That's how climate activists around the world describe it, whether they're committing acts of civil disobedience or organizing in different ways for political power. They talk about the point of no return, which is getting closer by the day. I wish they wouldn't do that. I mean, it's urgent, all right, but I don't see that there's any advantage to imagining some future date and trying to predict when it's going to be, how many years before it's too late. We're already in the climate crisis, and it's only going to get worse. The question now is the same as it's going to be in 10 years or 50 years from now, which is, what do we do now? So more and more young people, especially it seems, are thinking it's time to stop pretending, stop burning fossil fuels, And not just young people. 80-year-old Jane Fonda is getting herself arrested with weekly protests at the U.S. Capitol building. Fire drill Fridays, she's calling it, even though the fire's already going. Mary Louise Kelly on National Public Radio did just a terrible job of interviewing her about it. She asked Jane Fonda, "What are you doing to reduce your carbon footprint?" And then followed up with the idiotic gotcha question, "How did you travel to Washington yourself?" Forcing the victim to admit apologetically that she did fly there. Poor Jane Fonda. She's so clueless in some ways. She completely fell for the question. She mentioned that she's resolved never to buy clothes anymore and thinks of it as part of her social responsibility to reduce consumption and waste. I mean, she's been Jane Fonda all her life. Talk about wardrobes. Plus, she's 80 years old. Of course she doesn't need to keep buying more clothes. Anyway, it was Mary Louise Kelly's fault. She was trying to define the issue as, you say you want someone to do something about it. Well, what are you as a consumer doing to reduce carbon emissions? I wish Jane Fonda had said, look, Mary Louise, there is a reason that there's no action being taken by our government, and that reason is not because of what kind of car you or I drive. It's because of the billions of dollars being made on fossil fuels, and it's because our governments have failed to protect our security and our lives. Yeah, if I was Jane Fonda, that's what I would have said for sure. How did you get here? How did we get here, anyway? Maybe by agreeing to believe that the world's scientists are deluded? Buying some line that reality is whatever somebody says it is? I'm Michael Goldberg. I'm just trying to get a handle on all this. And that's why I turn to poetry and especially the poet Connie Wanick. She takes a long view in this poem from her collection, Consider the Lilies, the Mrs. God poems.
A sign. At the March for Science on Earth Day 2017. What did it say? God asked. Well, first, I should describe the day, Mrs. God replied. It reminded me of creation, an early, tender morning, pure light, the air thin, and every atom unclaimed, simple, remember? I think that's because there was no past. Exactly. Nothing had accumulated. No old shoes or out-of-date bifocals in a tangle. In those times, we were still discussing whether the chicken should lay the egg or whether the egg would need to hatch first, until you thought of simultaneity. God smiled, the most fluid of all his expressions. Anyway, Mrs. God continued, people were walking through the city. Sometimes they passed through the deep purple shadows of tall buildings. You could see them shiver, and the youngest clung to their mothers. Then they emerged into the light, and their arms opened like the wings of sunning ravens. Many simply walked, silent, happy to be among their kind. And others carried signs on sticks. Why, what was this march about? Well, oddly enough, it was about the value of the Homo sapiens' ability to reason, and honestly, I felt validated. We spent a lot of time working on that. We were too good to them. No. Well, maybe. Anyway, one woman who had a child at her side and another developing under her heart held up a sign that read, "What if heaven and earth were the same place?" God was silent. "I know," said Mrs. God. "She phrased it as a question?" he asked, reaching for Mrs. God's hand. Thank you.
Connie Wanick. Science marches on, and so does our ability to ignore it. Here's another Duluth poet, Lewis Jenkins.
Big brown pills. I believe in the big brown pills. They lower cholesterol and improve digestion. They help prevent cancer and build brain cells. Plus, they just make you feel better all over. I believe in coffee and beet greens and fish oil, of course, and red wine. In moderation, and cinnamon. Green tea is good, and black tea, and ginseng. I eat my broccoli. Nuts are very good, and dark chocolate has to be dark, not milk chocolate. Tomatoes. But I think the big brown pills really help. I used to believe in the little yellow pills, but now I believe in the big brown pills. I believe they are much more effective. I still take the little yellow ones, but I really believe in the big brown ones.
That's Lewis Jenkins. We'll hear more from him later in this hour about science in the 21st century. I gotta admit, all these climate change debates, it makes me confused. I mean, only 50 years ago, it seemed universally understood that scientific research and knowledge of the real world, learning everything we can about the world around us, was vital to civilization and to our lives. It was widely believed that ancient superstitions would fade away in the growing light of science and reason. This, of course, was before the rise of fundamentalism, the return of fundamentalism, I should say, late in the 20th century. It's been building ever since, and it's now burning merrily away in the halls of the U.S. Congress, as in Tehran at the Islamic Consultative Assembly. How did we get here? I asked science teacher Aaron Wenger to share his thoughts about that. He came into the studio wearing one of his favorite t-shirts, which has printed on it a list of short sentences on his chest. Earth is not flat. Vaccines work. We've been to the moon. Chemtrails are not a thing. Climate change is real. Stand up for science. Who could have imagined such a thing as stand up for science in the 21st century? So I asked him, what happened?
I think part of the reason for that splitting into a couple of camps rests on the shoulders of people like me. We didn't do enough of a good job of presenting people with the factual information. Where did it come from? How? Indeed, it's a good question. How can you be so sure of this? We needed to do a better job of presenting that. We needed to keep 3 out of 4 kids from becoming illiterate in science and math and things as they made their way through school. This thing that we see in Minnesota of this dichotomy between people who can do math and read, at an appropriate level of science or any other textbook, that dichotomy between two groups of people is, I think, the most dangerous thing that's ever occurred. It fosters the splitting into two camps, neither side of which can talk to the other. They can shout, but not talk to one another. At any rate, having spent a sort of lifetime in the business associated with science anyhow, we should have spent more time in your kids' sixth grade earth science part of the curriculum, not just spewing out facts and figures about the earth sciences. That's important, but the really important thing was giving the kid a sense of, indeed, where did that come from? This isn't opinion. What happens with carbon dioxide, water vapor, and methane in the atmosphere? That's not an opinion, baby. That's chemistry and physics.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that gets in our yelling that goes on these days, that sometimes gets modified by people saying, oh, yeah, well, you guys might be right about the chemistry or the physics about that, but it's got nothing to do with human activity. There's always been carbon dioxide. There's always been water vapor. The Earth has always undergone climate changes, they'll say. And again, if we had done a better job of talking about the impact, the fast exponential growth of human impact in this biosphere of ours. When I was teaching engineering, almost every class I taught, I don't care if it was a circuits class or if it was a statics class where we examined how bridges are built. I don't care what it was. I would start off almost always by as big as I can on a whiteboard, drawing about a 4-foot diameter circle with my arm. I try to get a nice circle. And then you'd say, well, that's got a radius of 2 feet. Earth is 4,000 miles about in diameter. So 2 feet is 4,000 miles. That means 1 foot is 2,000 miles. 6 inches is 1,000 miles, and so on. And you keep bringing that down till you could talk about the roughly 30,000 foot, that's about 6 miles, thickness of the Earth's atmosphere. And on that 4 foot diameter circle, that winds up being a smudge mark above the surface of the Earth, less than the eraser on a pencil. That's it, baby. That's where it all takes place. Now, in that, in let's say 1960, there was a population of perhaps 3.5, something like that, billion people. And of that population, probably only about 40% of it, if that, was technology, modern technology, using folks. Africa wasn't, India wasn't, China wasn't. When I was in China, 80% of the people still farmed the way their great-great-grandfathers did. None of that had changed yet. Somewhere along there, pick a date, 1970, 1980, whatever you want to pick, that started changing, with now probably something of 70 or 75% of a 7 billion population using the technology of flight, the technology of trains, the technology of cars, technology of electrical power, etc. That's the difference. That's what has overridden the normal normal atmospheric processes of this poor planet. That's us underneath that little smudge line on a 4 foot diameter circle.
That's Aaron Wenger, longtime instructor at Itasca Community College. Here's John Trudell with Terminal Neon.
Feeling a little imposed upon, and a whole lot unneeded. In walked Lucifer himself, wearing mismatched faded black, reflecting some hard times of his own. Terminal Neon, unsurrealistically real, as they keep slipping back into the familiar. Broken dreams, the falling tears, everybody feels, but nobody hears. The democratization of the sheep. The white sheep don't trust the black sheep. And it's all the shepherd's idea. Terminal Neon. The Third World War. The Third World is poor. The Third World War against the poor. All over the world, the ruling class rich, the Third World War against the poor. Terminal Neon, human weakness turned, addictions and other needing crimes, battlegrounds littered with self-respect, rage and frustration, the real desperation. Serial killers become the high priest in the culture of death without ritual. Terminal Neon, the angel of mercy, hasn't been showing much mercy these days. The have-nots want it, need it, pray for it. What the little things mean, everything all adds up. Human beings voided, humanoids, Terminal Neon, it's all very strange. Feeling a little imposed upon, and a whole lot unneeded. In walked Lucifer himself, wearing mismatched faded black, reflecting some hard times of his own.
John Trudell on KAXE KBXE. Today on Stay Human, we're thinking about the climate crisis and how we live with it and something about how we got here. To the Earth, humans just recently got here. But from our perspective, this current moment has been a long time coming. In a way, we humans have been at war with nature for many generations. And in the last couple of hundred years, it looked like we were winning. We've paved quite a bit of it by now, dammed the rivers and filled in the wetlands, caged or exterminated our larger competitors, and built an arsenal of drugs against our smallest living enemies. Seemed like humans were winning. But the war has turned, and it turned out we were making war on ourselves. What will our grandchildren's children think of us? In their history lessons in bunkered schoolrooms about how we kept on burning fossil fuels long after we understood what was happening. One of the very first things President Reagan did when he moved into the White House in 1981 was to take the solar panels off the roof. That symbolism was well understood at the time, but 40 years ago, no one could grasp how deep, how long-lasting, how devastating a symbol it would prove to be. And 40 years from now? The past cannot be undone, but it will follow us into the future. I think, along with the storms and rising seas, the upheavals caused by tens of millions more of us fleeing for safety, I think each of us individually will also be suffering a profound disorientation. There are some certainties that are so certain, the sun rises in the east each day, that we never think about them. They just form the baseline. That's what's normal. And normal is not a concept we're going to be able to apply anymore, not to the seasons, not to what we've long thought of as the natural world. We're going to have to learn to live in a world where there is no new normal. It just changes. And to do that, we'll have to invent new stories, new ways of figuring out where we are, what we're here for.
Thank you.
little seasonal mashup for you. If you think things are getting confusing now, just wait. You're tuned to Stay Human on your Northern Community Radio Service, KAXE-KBXE. Thanks to all the listeners whose membership contributions keep us on the air and in the cloud at KAXE.org. We also receive support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Coming up in this hour, Steve Downing contemplates climate madness. But first, we have this letter from the future. Well, from the fertile mind of Jeremiah Lind.
12/25/2095. Dearest survivors, chrononauts, and time clones, climate war is over. Merry Xmas. I write to you, as always, from the future, to the past, to prevent the horrifying presence. Over 4 years, beginning in 1983, the Brundtland Commission, so named for Gro Harlem Brundtland, the former Prime Minister of Norway and chairperson of the Commission, created their report, Our Common Future. It was and is a seminal text on responsible and balanced global development in a manner that would come to define the ideals and principles of sustainability, that being, development that meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. The Brundtland Report sounds very professional and comprehensive and global. But they probably would have gotten a lot more traction with sweet lunatic gods in heaven, we're all going to die on fire. 100-point font, bold, italics, underlined. Screamed at the top of the lungs while discussing it. Then, and only then, would our corporate overlords have considered pulling back on the carbon dump levers. In reality, Exxon scientists had identified some of the more damning climate models a full decade previous. As it turns out, if you destroy the living things that create oxygen, food, and pollination, you yourself have a hard time living. Who knew? Except all those pesky scientists. Those Poindexters with their charts and projections and models couldn't sell a room $2 wallets filled with $100 bills. Michael Mann couldn't threaten you with a hockey stick if it were made of plutonium. It's useless trying to explain science to people who don't understand science. At least success stories are rare. Bill Nye, for instance. Carl Sagan. Al Gore. Almost. Sweet Jumping Jack Flash Gordon Jesus, he used a scissor lift. Al Gore took the time and energy to rent a scissor lift to show you how absurd our carbon load was, raised it so high into the air to show that carbon. Carbonic acid isn't a problem if you have to get to work by car and aren't a coral reef. This is why it's easy to externalize costs, because to us, everything is external. We occupy the center of a brain contained inside a skull with an advanced primate mutant being thrown around on a space ball orbiting a flaming ball of fusion. There's no reason to think it gets any weirder than that. That's science, kids. If you want to layer or nuance or ignore that wholesale crazy, that is your choice. I can do relatively little to change it. The most I can do is try to communicate to you via this time phone and hope that someone in an informed future can action an extraction. It's on you to do everything else. I don't know how to perform surgery. I wouldn't even want to if I could. Why would I do that when there are perfectly rich people willing to do it for me? I don't want to sell shoes. I don't want to pick vegetables, except for the ones I grow to eat, or ones I'm stealing to eat later. Also, you can't steal food. Obviously can if you're in a store, for instance, and run away with it. But on the planet Earth, where plants grow, that is all for you. That is what the Earth has grown for you, an animal on it, to eat. That was its purpose. Despite what nation-states and or farmers with shotguns have to say in the matter. I wish that more people would have responded to our earlier Q reports, obviously. Zuckerberg, Musk, the Google AI. If only they would have been more willing to play ball before it all went into the fouled toilet. I was always for escaping to Venus. Poop on Venus, I said. Let's get some bacteria to stain that air. Cool off that nonsense. Turn the acid basic and let it precipitate. Once things cool down, it should precipitate and condense. A global feces rain. We would all be in space, of course, enjoying our lavish solar bases while firing our scat and experiments into the clouds below. With total control over the environment and the ability to CRISPR edit our genome, people could live into their thousands in a low-gravity, long-range, high-action life. Venusians. Using the planet as both a shield and as a source of power for massive solar hydrocarbon conversion plants. It would take a while, but having way too much atmosphere is a lot better problem than not having any at all. Once you created enough oxygen and removed enough acid, effectively smashing the greenhouse with millions of fecal hectares, You would have a smelly, though inhabitable, water world, which is so much better than not having anything, or being dead beneath the dead, dead ground. I have to hand it to Elon Musk. When he kills rich people in space, he does it with panache. The 21st century was generally lacking panache, but Musk really swung for the fences with SpaceX. What a noble dream. What a wild ride. What amazing explosions. Mars. What a weird place to die. So much farther away from the sun. So far away from any help of any kind. So cold and inhospitable and boring. What an awful hassle to have to put on a spacesuit for the entirety of your short irradiated days. So much red. Everyone would go green. That's when you know the end was near. We have rods for reds and cones for greens in our eyes, and when one or the other gets overused, bad things happen. Very bad, no fun things. Not to mention the rockets tipping over, those little spindly legs. Here we are only a couple of decades away from plowing a probe into the Martian surface at terminal velocity because someone used Imperial instead of metric. And we're going to spaceman spiff land on an unstable surface? Is there life on Mars? Not anymore, kids. So why can't we manage to save the Earth? Well, there is our killer instinct to consider. Not in a cruel or insane way, but in a way that all animals kill and eat one another. How is it our fault that we're simply so much better at killing and eating things than everything else? We don't even exercise. I consulted very deeply with the greatest climate scientist I've ever known and asked what were the three most important things we could do to mitigate climate change. The first and most important thing is to vote for people who acknowledge and understand climate change exists and that humans are the primary cause. Next, try to eat less meat, because telling anyone to eat no meat automatically labels you as a lunatic eco-fanatic. So fine, eat it. But the less you consume, the better. And honestly, who's eating a nightly porterhouse steak? Go ahead and give up your grade F beef for some chicken. Make good choices. Finally, educate yourselves. Read a damn book. Read a few. Emancipate yourselves, gentle mind slaves, from the shackles of ignorance. If you think you've learned everything you can possibly know, I would test that theory. I bet I could tell you a thing or two about stuff and things, because I know many things. Things that were, things that are, and some things that have not yet come to pass. For now, imagine that tomorrow aliens from a nearby galaxy will arrive in their colonizing warships, and they will have lasers, and laser swords, and orbital lasers, and suddenly it will become crystal clear that we are no longer at the top of the food chain. Imagine what that would mean to those who survived the initial attack. Imagine how any perceived differences in race or political ideology or education or class would disintegrate in the face of impending and total annihilation. Now imagine that alien is climate change. Now stop imagining. It is here. One infinite love. Q.
Jeremiah Lin, a writer, actor, and Imagineer living in Bemidji, Minnesota. Here's music for him from Frank Zappa.
Thank you.
You're tuned to Stay Human on Northern Community Radio. Each week, words and music for spirit and courage. Essayist Steve Downing is a regular contributor to our program, and he brings us this on climate madness.
A stroll down memory lane here at the top, back to the early 1960s, when I was in high school. Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, published in 1962, was everywhere. Booksellers couldn't get their hands on enough copies. At libraries, it was always checked out. Carson's particular focus, synthetic pesticides. There was already irrefutable evidence concerning the dangers of substances like DDT to people, to plant and animal life, to the planet. DDT. Could you ask for a better handle to attach to a poison, dichloral, diphenyl, trichloral ethane, widely in use everywhere agribusiness was big business? DDT. The first time you hear it, before you even know what it stands for, you know it means bad. Rachel Carson's work led to a ban on DDT and other pesticides, despite fierce pushback from the ag and chemical industries and lobbyists. And Carson was credited as a prime mover in the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency in 1970. Also in the rise of ecofeminism. More on that later. But then along came Ronald Reagan and the rollback of the environmental policies adopted in response to Rachel Carson and her work began. Go ahead, poison us. Mad. A year after Silent Spring hit the bookshelves, Stuart Udall published The Quiet Crisis. Udall, from Arizona, was a member of the House of Representatives when President Kennedy appointed him Secretary of the Interior. Note the modifiers in Udall's and Carson's titles. Silent. Quiet. One of Udall's central tenets is that civilizations decline when they forget to work with the land. Or in the case of this nation, when civilizations are forcibly resettled on land they don't understand, they have to start culturally from scratch. Udall has a poignant reference to that last ignominy. Within 40 years of the founding of Jamestown, the once powerful indigenous Powhatan nation was in effect homeless, existing functionally as beggars at the edges of where they once lived and ruled. They taught us how to survive in this climate and geography, and we rewarded them by destroying them. Mad. Events like that do set the stage. This country, from the start, has deemed itself so exceptional, no rules apply, even when we make them. Manifest destiny, a horrendous notion, is implicated here. As is every man for himself. Emphasis on man. Mad. Udall is unsparing in his historical reporting about America's environmental mistakes. But when I revisited the book recently, I was struck mostly by his naivete. Remember, this was 1963. He concludes that we have recovered a sense of reverence for the land, and from now on will be committed to wiser ways of preserving and enhancing our natural resources. Tell that to the current Secretary of the Interior, Udall's old job. David Bernhard is a former oil industry lobbyist whose principal accomplishment so far is opening up more federal land for oil, gas, and mineral extraction. Mad. Over at the Environmental Protection Agency, that administrator, Andrew Wheeler, is a former coal industry lobbyist and is himself a climate change denier. mad. I'm not sanguine about this, but if there's any hope for a future, it probably resides in the branch of feminism labeled ecofeminism, rising out of the relationship between women and Earth, the Earth, Mother Earth. Ecofeminism does not place women in a dominant position. Rather, it calls for an egalitarian collaboration in which there is no dominant group, and never mind silent or quiet, if only. Thank you.
That's the Turtle Island String Quartet playing Charlie Parker. Stay tuned at 6 o'clock for Jazz on America Avenue. I'm Michael Goldberg with Stay Human. Thanks to Steve Downing for his contribution to today's show and to our other climatologists, Connie Wanick, Aaron Wenger, Jeremiah Lind, and Lewis Jenkins, helping me keep track of which way the wind blows. Here's one more piece for us from Duluth poet Lewis Jenkins.
Earl. In Sitka, because they are fond of them, people have named the sea lions. Every sea lion is named Earl, because they are killed one after another by the orca, the killer whale. Sea lion bodies tossed here and there, right and left, into the air. At least he didn't get Earl, someone says. And sure enough, after a time, that same friendly, bewhiskered face pops to the surface. It's Earl again. Well, how else are you to live except by denial, by some palatable fiction, by some little song to sing, while the inevitable, the black and white blindsiding fact, comes hurling toward you out of the deep.
Shine your light until the break of dawn. And shine. are